Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock band.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
that guitar three.
I'm Red Beard, and today in the studio, I'm joined by Jim Kerr of Simple Minds to celebrate the greatest hits.
Promise to America, belief is our beauty thing.
Don't you forget about me.
There are so many factors come into play. Well, the first one's desire. You got to want it, and you have to continue to want it, and you got to still want it even when you've had it. So desire.
All the things she said, she said. You fought the fight so long, no surrender to temptation. All the things she said, she said.
You're still never really ready for it. You're never really ready because you've never been there. You don't know anyone who's been there. There's no manual. There's no book. There's no one you know that stood in the center of the stage and had that voice in his head that when, you know, thousands of people gone crazy, there's this voice in your head saying, you're a charlatan.
Let me go.
Hi, this is Jim Kerr of Simple Minds, in the studio to celebrate the greatest hits.
The dawn of the 1980s decade saw remarkable changes in the popular music world. The Beatles were already 10 years gone. Led Zeppelin was abruptly halted. The Rolling Stones were sounding stale and soon to go on hiatus. And The Who announced their final tour. It wouldn't be, but the punk rock movement, never claiming nor intending to be a beginning, but rather an ending, had blown up like a dinosaur stepping on a landmine, and a flurry of fresh-faced bands with exciting new approaches flooded through the breach with names like The Police, The Clash, U2, REM, and The Cure. But precious few of those, or their peers then, exist today. Simply because navigating the ever-changing shoals of pop music, fad, fashion, and technology is, well, not simple. It's very complex, and to endure over the decades takes a single-minded focus, a yeoman stamina, and a wee bit of luck. The age at which hopes and dreams meet youthful wanderlust, as it turns out, knows no country, according to Simple Minds co-founder Jim Kerr.
It ties in with the band, really, because at the age of 16, there was a summer. I mean, there wasn't a lot going on in Glasgow. It was a different, very much a, you know, different town from now. There wasn't a vibrant music scene. There wasn't a lot going on. And the one thing we loved was when bands came to town, especially international bands. And you can imagine what it was like when someone like Alice Cooper came to town, or Lou Reed or Bowie or something. And we had this fantastic venue. However, at the age of 16, they closed the venue for about a year for a refurbishment, which meant that we were kind of starved of live music. And at the same time, it was all starting to happen. I had a friend that had gone down to London, and how quaint is this? He used to send us letters saying, there's this thing called the Sex Pistols, and you got to see it. It's playing the Ford Green pub, and it's amazing, and you know, you got to come down. And anyway, lo and behold, Charlie and I, we would hitchhike to see the bands where sometimes maybe they were only coming to Newcastle, or maybe they were coming up, no, Liverpool, Manchester. Anyway, one journey we were hitchhiking down to see the Sex Pistols, but the guy, even hitchhiking itself is quaint. Now, no one does that now unless you're crazy. The world's too nuts to do it. But just in case people thinking, it seemed you didn't think about it. Anyway, this lift we got, the guy said, I'm going to Paris. And so we didn't see the Sex Pistols, regrettably. But we did see Jim Morrison's grave, and we saw Oscar Wilde's grave, and we moved on through Germany, all these great, great cities of, you know, all associated with music, places that we love, the krautrock scene of Cologne and Munich and Berlin. And within that journey, I still maintain we're on that journey, because within that journey, we had nothing, you know. We had a plastic bag with a few T-shirts. Everyone else had stoves and tents and all that stuff. We had nothing, but there was a great emancipation, and there was a great, great feeling of, you know what, it's amazing what happens if you stick out your thumb. And there's an element to that. Of course, we romanticize it. It's to us, it's our version of Huckleberry Finn. It's our version of on a road, yeah. But I think it's core. I think that trip was really core to the journey that we're still on.
Promise to America, belief is a beauty thing. Break wonder reach
as love takes our train. Summer breeze and brilliant light. Only love she sees, she controls all love. Love sails to a new light.
Promise to America, belief is a beauty thing. As golden days break wandering,
all the love she sees, he controls her love. Life knows a grave where everything is possible. Promises, everything is possible.
Oh. I promised you a miracle.
Promises, promises.
As golden days break wandering,
reflects on them a while. Love speaks so quietly, slipping back on golden tides, breathing windscreen memories.
Is a beauty thing.
Promises, promises.
As golden days break wandering,
all the love she sees, he controls her love. Life goes ahead, everything is possible. Of life, everything is possible.
Break wandering.
celebrate the hits of Simple Minds, you start with the UK number 13 hit in 1982 from New Gold Dream called Promised You a Miracle, which, by the way, has never sounded better than on that remastered version. To understand how there is a Simple Minds this far into the 21st century, look at the lifelong friendship and creative collaboration of guitarist-songwriter Charlie Burchill and singer, keyboard player, lyricist Jim Kerr, who joins me again in the studio.
You know, when you're 21, 22, you can't imagine beyond the next year. However, Charlie and I, we grew up in this sort of housing scheme in Glasgow, this project. And don't get me wrong, we loved it. We loved it. But it was getting a little rough. When we grew up, drugs and stuff hadn't come into the community. There was unemployment and stuff. But you know, all that, you know, heavy thing had. And I came back from, I was still living with my parents because, you know, we had very little money then whenever we weren't playing. And I came back and, you know, the building was, it was gone down. And I remember going to the bank manager and someone had told me this, you can get a mortgage and the bank manager, but you got to give him a business plan and all that. And I remember going along with the bank manager and I told him, I said, listen, I want to get a place, my parents and did it. And he said, great. So I think we can do that. He said, what have you got? What can you give me for a collateral? And I said, well, what's that? And he said, you know, a deposit and stuff. And I said, for what? He said, well, I need something. You're coming in here. I need to see something from your side. And I said, oh, I've got a lot of reviews here. And I pulled this little scrapbook that my mum had put, and he said, ah, you're going to give me that paper, those papers, and I'm going to give you, you know, it was like the deal was for, but you know, probably equivalent to about $100,000. It was a lot of money then. It's a lot of money still, except you won't buy how many houses in Glasgow for it. But you know what? Yeah, he said to me, so yeah, over the next 4, 5, 6 years, and I was like, 4, 5, 6 years? No, couldn't think that far. I thought my parents are going to be out in their neck in a year's time. Not only did no one have any concept of time, as you said, no one had any concept of money either. I mean, you know, you knew rock stars in the 70s lived in the south of France and stuff, but there wasn't the quite, you know, you didn't know what anyone earned or what the box office was or you know, what David Bowie got for an advance on Ziggy Stardust. And I mean, all that stuff came later, where suddenly you know, you could read box office and you could read other businesses. But no one had any concept of that stuff. We signed with Arista Records when we began, which actually was quite an obscure label in the UK compared to, you know, compared to CBS and EMI and Polygram and all that. But why did we sign with them? Well, they'd Lou Reed, Patti Smith and Iggy Pop. We thought, that's just the greatest thing ever. They must be the most musical label out. So I remember when we signed with them and going into their record company for the first time, and God, even that was an experience. You know, it was marbled halls just the back of the Hyde Park. Just, you know, I'd never seen any like it. And I thought, wow, this is the home of Iggy and Lou and Patti Smith. But I remember when we went in the hall, there was only one portrait on the wall, and it was this huge portrait of one of their artists. And you might be surprised that it wasn't Lou, it wasn't Iggy, it wasn't Patti Smith, it was Barry Manilow. I said to my manager, why they got, with all due respect, and he said, he pays for it all. And that's when I kind of, you know, the pennies were dropping all around me. And I thought, Lou doesn't make money. My manager was shaking his head. I thought, no wonder he's only got that one leather jacket. No wonder Iggy hasn't even got a shirt.
1984 Sparkle in the Rain album was already Simple Minds' sixth, but the autobiographical Waterfronts is a snapshot of the Clyde legendary shipbuilding works rusting into oblivion, and it serves as a eulogy for that period in Glasgow's history. Simple Minds singer, keyboard player Jim Kerr recalls their humble beginnings.
Back then, your crew and all that, they were your mates. They weren't guys that had done it for 10 years previously. You know, it took a while to get pro, and you didn't really want to get pro, you know, because you wanted to do it your way and stuff, and it's also cheaper. Yeah, someone has said, yeah, get them. I remember one guy, he said, yeah, kid, we said, like, you know, we're going to have for 6 months, you want to come? He said, hell yeah. We said, you know, what do you want? He went, Chinese food every night. And we went, you're on. I'm not sure if we added to that, but in case there's any labor unions listening. But I mean, that was like, what? I can go around the world and get Chinese food every night. You know what? It kind of pretty much summed up us. I mean, we would have paid you to let us play music, except two things. First of all, we didn't have any money, and secondly, we're Scotsmen. To be fair, you know, a lot of the contemporaries, our ilk then, when I say the ilk, the people we would meet out on the road, of course, you two were one of them, The Cure, Depeche Mode were coming through, REM were making a noise, you know, there was a lot of bands. But I suppose, you know, you two and Simple Minds had, we had quite a few things that made us even more in common, perhaps. Apart from sharing the Celtic blood and Blarney. Well, we were the same thing. We were school bands as well, really. You know, they were a school band. They met at school. Simple Minds came out of a school friendship. It was organic. If you'd gone through their record collection, we would have all... We'd have the exact same records, apart from the fact they might have had one or two more Rory Gallagher than us. So there was a lot of things in common, the idealism. I mean, the point I always make, I say, look, you know, let's not forget, there's only one you two. There really is only one you two. But you know what? There's only one Simple Minds as well. Don't you
tell me how seeming American success in 85 with Don't You Forget About Me from the Breakfast Club soundtrack.
Yeah.
Tell me how that was a sword that cut both ways for Simple Minds.
Well, the obvious thing was that it gave us that great success. It went to number one not only here, but around the world.
Oh, I didn't realize it was such an international hit as well.
It was indeed,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, great.
I mean, it really was. And the great thing about that, obviously, took us through the door into the big league. And the other great thing is that it made a hell of a lot of people happy. You know, a lot of fans, especially college kids, that's become their kind of anthem. So to be part of that is a great thing. The other side was that we're the type of people who like to, any success we've had, we like to think we really worked for it. You know, we went out and sweated and done the thing. And Don't You was rather a kind of a gift that landed on our lap. The song was presented to us by a guy called Keith Forsey, who wrote the song. And when we heard it, we thought it sounded like us, but there was something kind of missing. However, we thought we should do this because it's only going to be one of many tracks on this soundtrack for this, what we thought would be, catch this, an obscure American teenage movie. And not only does it go on to be the lead track from a, you know, an absolute blockbuster of a movie. So we got this success, and a journalist asked me about that. He said, what did this song not, was it like a suit that didn't fit? And I said, it wasn't quite that. It felt like a suit we had stolen. You know, it was kind of like this.
Still had the tag on it.
Exactly. And looking back now, we're obviously a lot less precious about it. But we were nervous, you know. We were slightly confused. I remember U2 had worked for 5 or 6 years and had never had. They were always getting great kind of a critical. They were always, it was, you know, coming up the right way. And I met them in a hotel in New York, and we were number one. And they'd never had they hadn't had a big hit by then. And I knew that we hadn't done a tenth or a 20th of the work that those guys had put in. And so, you know, maybe it's our own. You know, there was a sense of. We felt a little oily about the whole thing, but the great thing is that, you know, people really enjoyed that song.
Playing devil's advocate here.
Yeah.
In hindsight, do you think you made too much of a big deal? Did you think you let people know how uncomfortable you were with the success of that song? Maybe a little too much?
No, I think what happened was I actually only said it once, and it was used in a quote in Rolling Stone, and everyone said, "What's this guy bitching about? he's number one." And it was a good story. The guy who doesn't want the hits, yeah. And so, I far be it from me to say to people, especially the fans, you know, paying money for a song, and I'm like, "What do you want this thing for?" I would never do that. I think we were too honest about it.
It's probably just being honest.
Yeah, we just don't make very good liars back there. It tends to be written all over our faces, so we kind of get it out.
Well, don't change.
Yeah.
Don't change that aspect at all.
Next, Jim Kerr tells us the next chapter in the Simple Minds saga that begins with the words, "Once Upon a Time." Follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear more from your favorite rockers at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Jim Kerr of Simple Minds, as we celebrate the greatest hits.
Hi, this is Jim Kerr of Simple Minds, in the studio to celebrate the greatest hits.
And I'm Redbeard, and when I want to start my day with joyous melodies, uplifting lyrics, driving rhythms, and rich full sound, invariably I seem to reach for Simple Minds' 1985 mid-80s masterpiece called Once Upon a Time. In its way, it's almost the greatest hits of the period, including Alive and Kicking, All the Things She Said, Sanctify Yourself, and Ghost Dancing. Here's the co-writer and singer of all of them, Jim Kerr of Simple Minds, with me in the studio.
Melodies, it seems such an obvious thing to say, but a bold melody that just strikes you. I mean, all of those songs that you say there, when you mention them to me, although I wrote the words, the first thing I'm thinking is, good tune, good tune. Good tune, good tune. And sometimes we forget that. I mean, seriously, good tunes, I think. And so it's all to do with it. If you believe you get a good tune, all the other investments worthwhile. And also, I tell you one thing we do in a funny way, although on one hand I'm saying we don't pander and all that stuff, we're much more relaxed about playing stuff to people early on, not in a way of kind of playing something saying, hey, what do you think? Because then suddenly everyone's an expert. And also you don't want to put them, but you know, people can really do, what were you doing? I'm just listening to this track. Oh, yeah. Oh, that sounds great. And that sounds really good. Can you play it again? And it reconfirms what you were feeling about it. And so you just get more confident.
You turned me on.
With the release of Alive and Kicking, followed by the parent album Once Upon a Time in October 1985, Simple Minds put the world on notice that the previous year's UK number one for Sparkle in the Rain was simply an appetizer. Like every Simple Minds song, the lyrics had been written by singer, keyboard player Jim Kerr, sitting at his kitchen table in Glasgow, a process in a place which was, as it turns out, virtually important to the inspiration and continuity of Simple Minds.
Well, of course, in the early days, it was the only space, and anyone else, wait till the whole house goes quiet, everyone goes to bed, and I'd sit with the headphones, and that was the time, that was a meditational time, that was the time to really sort of marinate in the music, and the lyrics would, I would get lost in the music, and the lyrics would kind of suggest themselves. As we all grew up and got flash and got our own places and all that stuff, that table was left behind. But the last 10 years, through one thing or the other, I was back in Glasgow a lot more. And as the families moved houses, the tables pretty much stayed the same. And when something works, you attach this sort of a symbolicness to it, and you think, yeah, this is fertile ground, yeah. And you have your little, it's the same with playing live, you have your little props that somehow either truly or trick yourself into working.
Oh,
releasing in late 1985, the Once Upon a Time album fell into the worldwide transition of popular music from the vinyl phonograph era to the digital compact disc, and with the possible exception of Dire Straits, no band sold more CDs worldwide than Simple Minds in the mid-80s. Again, Jim Kerr.
And you mentioned Once Upon a Time there. We, you know, since the advent of the, when the CD took over, and of course, you know, oh, you can put 60 minutes of music on it or more or whatever. You know what? No one's got 60 minutes of great music. No one. There's, you know, they've got their stuff. And then I know that the album format that we still all love and revere, despite it sinking on a daily basis, its reputation and significance, but we still adhere. I know that it was about 45 minutes because of the technicalities of the vinyl and stuff, but, you know, 8, 9, 10 songs, I think it's enough for anyone to take in. It, you know, as long as they're quality, that's the key.
Yourself, open up your heart, sacrifice yourself. yourself. Sanctify, sanctify yourself.
Some swinging Scottish soul there from Once Upon a Time, courtesy of Simple Minds on the throbbing Sanctify Yourself, with that great Charlie Burchill guitar solo leaping octaves. Coming up next, Simple Minds leaps from the stage of London's Live Aid and the screen of MTV into the next decade of the 90s. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and check out a whole universe of rock interviews at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Jim Kerr of Simple Minds to celebrate the greatest hits.
Hi, this is Jim Kerr of Simple Minds, in the studio to celebrate the greatest hits.
And I'm Redbeard. Writing on AllMusic.com, John O'Brien correctly observes, quote, "It's easy to forget that during the era of Brat Pack movies and Live Aid, Simple Minds was U2's biggest challenger for the globe-straddling stadium rock crown," end quote. Wow, no pressure there, right? But by 1991, the carefree once-upon-a-time fairy tale of the 80s had given way to real life in the new 90s for Simple Minds.
Jim Kerr in Dallas from Glasgow with a leather jacket with a tartan lining.
Tell me everything you can think about this delightful song, See the Lights. When was it written? Who wrote it? And how did the arrangement build? It's a simple song, and no pun intended.
Yeah, no pun intended, and I'm glad you picked up on that, because there was one thing used to disappoint us as songwriters. I think the fact that we were brought up as well with a lot of the progressive rock bands, there was a lot of great music then, but when you think of the way the songs would be written, maybe the bass player had a riff and the keyboard player had a line, and it was maybe 10 things made the actual songs. And a lot of our music seemed like that, where you needed a big keyboard pad and you needed the guitar riff and you needed this. And we always hoped for the day would come when we could write some songs as well, like a busker could play, or someone sitting at home and a piano could play, where you just have the basic chords.
A busker is like a street musician,
yeah, right? Yeah, sorry,
street corner singer.
Yeah, we always hoped that one day we could have the faith in the melody that it wouldn't need necessarily embroidered, and go with a kind of underlying kind of power, underlying emotion building up. And the great thing for us is that this song "See the Lights" appeared, and it seems to, that there's not a lot going on in it at all, but it seems to build and build to this kind of a feeling of redemption or something, a crescendo. And that to us, as writers, when I say us, I mean Charlie Burchill, the guitar player, and myself, is a really great hopeful sign for the future, because we never really thought of ourselves for songwriters for years. We just thought we were guys from Glasgow who made this kind of a positive noise. But actual songs, we thought, no, that's the McCartneys of the world, and the Simons and Garfunkels and the Don Henleys and people like that. And I think we've got a beautiful song there, a song that's really, there's not a lot going on bar a very basic song, chord pattern. And I think the riff was something Charlie was playing during the sound checks and the last tour. And we never go back to the hotels now after the sound checks. We stay in the hall. We take a room and a little tape recorder, and we're always working on the next ideas.
Wow!
And I think that came
impressive.
Out. Yeah, that came out of that bag.
Storms inside.
See the Lights has another lovely Charlie Burchill melody framing the lyrics and vocal of Jim Kerr from the 1991 Simple Minds album Real Life. Though they could now afford to live in music business meccas like London, New York City, or Los Angeles, Simple Minds plowed their profits back into a rural studio north of Glasgow at a place called Loch Earn. Here's Jim Kerr with me in the studio.
It's a great kind of community. It's a great place to go back to, you know, in a year like this, which will be hyper activity and obviously will be centre of attention and all that. When you go back there, the dust kind of settles and you get a perspective and you get a pace, you get a sense of reality again. And it's a great, as they say, home is where the heart is and all those kind of cliches, but it is true.
Do you notice with maturity, does that importance increase or decrease?
No, I think when we were teenagers, the natural thing was to turn your back.
Sure.
You know,
on everything.
Every single thing.
Sure.
And then you think, hang on a minute, you know, you realize the strength you get from places like that. You realize the values you were brought up with. And we just feel incredibly lucky because we seem to have both worlds. We get to go out and tour and travel. In the last 10 or 12 years, the kind of friendships we've made, people, and listen to their tales and their anecdotes. And you have a sense of the world, but still you have this great base to go back to.
That's nice.
Take a walk in the park.
some of the more kind of a cynical journalists always have this question. They'll say, you know, real life, what does a rock star know about real life?
And come on.
Exactly, you know, and I think, hang on.
You
know, it doesn't matter whether you're a astronaut or whether you're a teacher or whether you're some unemployed, whatever. Everyone has a real life. Everyone has an emotional life. But it's, I think this album is a return back to the more kind of individual thoughts and the private concerns. I think it seems to be about those subjects.
Yeah. What are the people in Loch Éireann
like?
I mean, what's some of the main industries? What kind of a size of a town, and how do the people make a living?
Oh, village. Fishing or forestry, you know, things like that.
Sounds like a lot like our Pacific Northwest then.
Exactly. It was funny when we first moved up there, and we had to go to a local meeting to get the permission to build, and they were very, you know, they were thinking, what's going on here, a rock band, and what's that? And it's like, you know, 60, 65-year-old, 70-year-old, you know, Scotsman, like, well, laddie, yeah. And what time will you be up to? And will there be cars, you know, coming and going in the middle of the night and stuff? And at first, they were really, you know, they were very wary. Mm. But on the contrary, now they've got, you know, pictures of us up in the local pub. And the guys played at the Christmas dance for the old age pensioners. The guys put on the kilts and got the accordions out.
The band?
Yeah, yeah. And played for the pensioners, which, you know, done us a lot of favours. And the great thing is, when the old ones went home and told the teenagers, you know, these simple boys were playing at our...
These simple boys
and the teenagers were saying, who? These simple boys.
You must know them.
You must have heard of them.
The simple boys.
And the teenagers were like, you're joking.
The man.
Yeah, those simple boys making a noise. Charlie Burchill's uncanny one-note guitar hook is simply infectious on the song She's a River from Good News from the Next World, 1995's album by Simple Minds. Again, singer, keyboard player, lyricist Jim Kerr with me in the studio.
It's a beautiful thing when you're sitting with a new tune, because I like getting up early in the morning. The day is full of promise. The world is full of promise by 10:30. You're thinking, nah, let's leave it till tomorrow. Yeah, but you know, when you're sitting with that new idea, you're not thinking, oh, well, you know, hey, we're Joe Hotshot. We did this and we did that, and aren't we clever clogs? No, you're not. You've got it all to lose. And that's the same, you know, stretching that to the gigs. One of the things most pleased about with the band when it comes to play live is the attitude. I mean, I swear I use the word attack. We attack every single gig as though it was the last night on earth. We don't think, I said earlier, you know, that's one of the things of progress. We don't anymore think, well, oh, that's a big gig and this is a little gig, or that's a prestigious gig and this is, you know, some backwoods or something. Every night you go on stage, what are we saying when we go on stage now? We're saying one thing, really. We're saying this is what we've done with our lives. And we wouldn't want to give less than 100%, whether we were playing a bar mitzvah or Madison Square Garden.
When my love said to me, meet me down by the gallows tree, for it's sad news I bring about this old town and all that it's offering. Some say troubles abound, someday soon they're gonna pull the old town down. One day we'll return here when the Belfast child sings again. Brothers, sisters, where are you now? As I look for you right through the crowd, all my life here I've spent with my faith in God and church and the government. Some say troubles abound, someday soon they're gonna pull the old town down. One day we'll return here when the Belfast child sings again.
There are so many factors come into play. Well, the first one's desire. You got to want it, and you have to continue to want it, and you got to still want it even when you've had it. So desire, you know, you really got to want it, and you got to want it in fashion, out of fashion. You got to want it when it works, when it doesn't work. You got to want it when you're full of ideas, when you're running on empty. And I think that desire makes you go the extra mile. It makes you pick yourself up when you've been down, and also it makes you ignore stuff when it's gone really well. You just think, yeah, well, whatever.
Won't you come on home? goes on. Sings again. When the Belfast child sings again,
on Belfast Child, the fife and the fiddle calling me back to somewhere I've never been. Not surprisingly, Belfast Child was another runaway number one in the UK in 1989 for Simple Minds. Still to come, the band finds sustaining a viable recording career on the doorstep of the new millennium anything but simple. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and hear and see much more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Jim Kerr of Simple Minds. In the studio to celebrate the greatest hits.